Welcome, everybody. I am sitting down tonight with M.R. James, a legend in the archery field, member of the Hall of Fame in archery, founder, editor of Bowhunter magazine, and just author, just a multitude of things that you've done throughout your life and your hunting career. Why don't you tell me? I really appreciate you sitting down with me tonight and talking. And as we were just talking a second ago, I got a chance to, through Tom Nelson, I met him up at Grayling through a Fred Bear event, and we were talking. I got a chance to interview him, and I know since I posted that video, I kind of let you know that Tom was talking a little bit about you, one of the guys that he really enjoyed hunting with and still does. And that's kind of how me and you got a chance to get to know each other a little bit. We've been back and forth on Facebook, and even tonight we had a little doing the Zoom thing tonight, so I appreciate we figured things out. So, how about we start out with what's been going on in your life lately? What have you been doing? I know you on Facebook get out in the woods quite a bit every day. How it looks? Tell me what's going on in MR James' life right now.
Well, I've retired from bow hunter. I'm still active in bow hunting. I started bow hunting seriously in the early 60s and killed my first buck in Indiana in 63. And by luck, pure luck, I didn't really know what the heck I was doing, but it was a Pope and Young buck. And it was the first six pointer to ever make the record book. And I killed it in southern Indiana here one cold November day. In fact, it was the last day of gun season. Back in those days, we combined the gun and bow season, and so I was wearing a blaze orange hat in the picture. I've always loved the outdoors. I grew up hunting small game in Illinois. Took up archery because a friend of mine in Illinois got me into some target archery, and because I hunted so much, I loved the idea of hunting with a bow, and so I took up the bow. And I was blessed to have some degree of success early on. And so I had an idea that if there were people out there like me who had a lot of questions getting started, if there was some way I could get involved and help them become better bow hunters, that was one of my goals and has been for a long time.
Yeah, at that time there was probably not a, I mean, like today's world, it seems like no matter where you look, there's podcasts, there's videos, there's Facebook. I mean, everybody's got information out there that you can find. So probably when, like you said, back then, that was a big deal for a lot of hunters to get a magazine like that.
Well, the thing was, we had Archery Magazine, which was a field archery publication, National Field Archery Association. Roy Hoff, who was the editor, he bought that first story I ever wrote and sold to a national magazine about that six-point buck. I got to know Roy. I also wrote later on. There was a magazine called Bow and Arrow. And it's, I think, Bow and Arrow Hunting Today. And then there's another, Archery World, which is still around, but in a different form.
Yeah, as a kid, I remember going to like some of the grocery stores where they'd have all the big magazine racks and everything. And as a kid, I mean, me and my brothers, we would go and kind of look through all the hunting magazine sections. And but yeah, so that's kind of funny. I mean, how things have really changed over the years too.
Well, my job, I was a communications manager for the Mag & Bucks company, and we moved to Fort Wayne, my wife and family. And I put out the company publications. I was responsible for public relations, that sort of thing. And I still carried that love of hunting. And it just so happened there on the Management Club newsletter, one time I used a picture of a hunter, bow hunter at full draw, and I said, "Don't miss the next management club meeting." It was for the employees at management club. And I got a call from Don Clark, who was an engineer there. And he said, "Are you a bow hunter by any chance?" And we said, "Yeah." Well, he said, "We are too. Bob Schissler and I, we work in the, this, We were in the government division. We made radios for fighter jets and
Okay.
sonobuoys for submarine detection, that sort of thing there. It wasn't the TV branch of Magnavox. But anyway, we to make a long story short, we formed a club there, an archery club for Magnavox employees.
Okay.
And when we didn't get all that many people, we decided to open up to the public, and the Tysepe Bow Hunters was born. And today, it is still in existence as one of the
Very
oldest
cool.
clubs in Indiana, archery clubs.
Awesome.
And Don and Bob were just great people. And I had a fellow working for me, Steve Doucette, who was in the graphics department. And he put my publications together. I had a monthly magazine. I had a weekly newsletter. I put out all these releases. And Steve and I worked together. Well, the four of us sitting around one day said, wouldn't it be great if there was an all bow hunting magazine? I mean, we don't care that much about field archery. We love it, but we don't want to know how to hunt and hunt big game with bow. And that's how Bow Hunter Magazine was born in 1971.
Awesome. So tell me a little bit about then, like through the days through Michigan with like Anderson Archery, getting a chance to tell me something about your times with Fred Bear. Do you have a funny story or just a story that really comes through? You probably have a lot of them.
Well, yeah, but I got to know Tom Nelson basically because I was invited to be a speaker at the Anderson clinics every
Okay.
Father's weekend in June. And I would go up with guys from the magazine. We would sell magazines. We'd sell my books. I started writing books. And so we'd sell books, but we met people, and we just tried to meet and greet fellow bow hunters. And we hit it off, and things went really well. I met Tom. He was just a kid back then. And we've hit it off so well that we continue to hang around together when we can. And I don't know how many hunts we've been on together, but a lot, a lot. And so the story there, Ted Nugent would show up at these annual meetings.
Okay.
I didn't know Ted at that time.
How old would he have been probably at the time?
Oh gosh,
Probably pretty.
he was just a kid. I mean, he was a kid to me, but no, he showed up in his big zebra striped SUV, and man, I mean, he walking around. Here's this tall guy with ponytail, and I mean, but he was very approachable. The people up there idolized him. I wasn't a rock and roll fan. I mean, I liked Elvis, but I didn't know Ted. We became good friends. Ted and I have never hunted together per se, but he's been to my Montana ranch, and we visited. He and Shemaine and Rocco came out there. And but getting back to Anderson, I would put on these talks, but I also got to meet every other speaker. And this was like a who's who of bow hunting, including Fred Bear. And to be able to sit down with these guys, and Fred particularly, and listen to some of the stories when we
Right.
weren't meeting and greeting the public, it planted some seeds that have lasted with me and really flourished over the years.
That's definitely interesting. Now, did you ever get a chance to hunt with Fred Bear or not?
No, I didn't hunt with Fred.
Okay.
Fred wasn't doing all that much hunting when I got to know him. I met him in 1972 at a Pope and Young convention
Okay.
in Denver, Colorado. And at that time, I was named editor of the first Pope and Young record book. It had never been.
Okay.
I met Glenn St. Charles and Fred and all the directors. And I got to work with those guys helping put that first record book together. And so that's where I really got to know Fred.
Awesome.
And I would see him from time to time. And he was just everything that most people think. He was friendly, he was outgoing, he was so knowledgeable. And to sit and listen to his stories was just a real treat. And I'll never forget the times that we did spend together.
Yeah, I think everybody that I've talked to, from Tom Nelson and a lot of other people, that's one thing they always say about Fred Bear. He was very approachable, just an average Joe guy that would sit down next to you and you'd talk hunting.
One quick story about Fred. At that first Pope and Young convention, Don Clark, Bob Schisler, and Steve Doucette, and a friend from Fort Wayne was, we were sitting at a table. And in those days, meals were served cafeteria style. So we went through the line, we took our trays, went back to the table, and there were six seats at the table, and there were only five of us. And we look up, and this one friend who was there idolized Fred Bear. And he, when he first saw him, he said, "Well, there's Fred Bear." And I said, "Yeah, why don't you go and talk to him? He'll talk to you." No, I couldn't do that. Anyway, we're sitting there and I'm looking up, and here comes Fred with his tray of goodies for the meal. And he walks over to our table and he looks down and he says, "Do you mind if I join you fellows?" And of course, no, we didn't mind. But he sat down next to this kid. The kid's name was Gary Terpshinov. And Fred, first thing he did was turn to Gary and he stuck out his hand and said, "Hi, my name's Fred Bear. What's yours?" And I mean, I don't think Gary washed his hand the rest of the trip back to Indiana. He just was in awe.
Starstruck
That, that's
there.
indicative of how Fred was. He was
Yeah, that's
very,
pretty cool.
yeah.
So how about you said about your tell me about your first whitetail you took them or tell me
Well,
that story and
I've written about it several times. It was the last day of the season. I cut class. I was in college at the time. I cut classes the last afternoon of the season to go hunting. And we were hunting the overgrown stripper pits, strip mine pits in southern Indiana. And I drove out by myself. And I had, in all of the previous two seasons of field deer hunting, I had seen a total of two deer. I mean, they just weren't around. I mean, if you found tracks. But anyway, that last day, I started walking out through this brush and I kicked up some deer. I saw these flags waving and I said, "Oh man, there goes." I thought, "Well, I'm going to follow them." I thought I could catch up with them or something. You know how that was. But I followed. And I was in a dry creek bed, kind of, it was quiet, it was sandy bottom, and no water. I was walking along and I hear a stick break just ahead, and I stop and I get out an arrow and put it on the string just in case. And a doe steps into the shooting lane about 25 yards away and just turns and looks at me and walks on. And the next thing I know, this buck steps in, this Pope and Young class buck. And he
Awesome.
turns and looks at me, and my heart goes into overdrive. But I had the wherewithal to draw the bow, and I shot, and I hit him. But my heart was beating like crazy. I sat there as long as I could, and I finally had to go up and look to see if I could find blood or whatever. And I couldn't find. I found some cut hair, and I found a few drops of blood, and it was starting to get dark. So rather than push him, I drove home, called up one of my fishing buddies who was also a college classmate of mine. We went back the next day and picked up the blood trail, and he'd only gone maybe 100 yards, and we found him. And that was, I didn't know anything about the Pope and Young records, but I did eventually enter him in the book. And as I said, he was the first 6 point to make the record book. I keep him here, the mount here in my office to remind me. And he only had 6 points, but he had incredible mass at the bases. His in that first record book, his antler bases, one was over 6.5, and the other in just a hair under 7 inches. And that was larger than any buck in the Pope and Young records at that time, including Mel Johnson's world record. But that's just a sidelight, but I couldn't believe my luck, and that was all it was pure luck.
So that kind of started your whole continuing this passion and where
And
you've gone to and where you're at right now.
selling the story, that made my day, but I didn't like the half and half of the other existing archery magazines, half target archery, half bow hunting. And the guys agreed that we need an all bow hunting magazine, and that started in 71 and still going today. It's not the same magazine, but it's still going.
Yeah, things have really changed in the media as far as between magazines and social media presence and stuff. So, still kind of nice to see the magazine out there and stuff. I mean, it's
Oh, yeah.
there's
Well, I walk
subscriptions
on
and
the
all that.
newsstand
And
still, and I
yeah.
keep going to magazine. I think I know that publication.
Yeah, it's got to feel cool just seeing that in the magazine rack yet after all
Yeah.
these years. Quite the accomplishment and stuff. At the time when you took that whitetail, what type of equipment were you using?
I was using a 46 pound, I think it was 45, 46 pound Colt, COLT. The firearms company made a few bows back in that day, and I bought a Colt Huntsman. I was shooting cedar arrows tipped with bear razor heads, and I told Fred that, and he approved. In fact, brought in choice. He thought it was good. And I was wearing army surplus camo, bought at an army surplus store, military camo, and I had that orange hat on because that was a law since there were gun hunters out there too.
So both were going at the same time then, gun and archery.
Right,
That's pretty
right.
interesting. As
It's
far as
different.
the equipment you had, like in that back in the 60s and stuff, was like in today's world, you can buy stuff online. You can go to the corner store or Walmart or something and buy stuff. I mean, it's
Right.
probably like, where did you really buy or make your equipment from back
My
then?
best hunting buddy in Indiana was a fellow named Jack Reinhart, and he had an archery shop. And we hunted together all over. He was in Colorado with me when I first killed my first mule deer. He and I were close friends, and he set me up and with equipment. And I bought the bow. I didn't buy that bow from him, but my next bow was my all-time favorite recurve. And that was made by the Wilson Brothers, Black Widow recurve, 60-pound Black Widow. And I took my first bear with it, and it is still, as I mentioned, all my all-time favorite. They just it's a class bow. Their bows are class, first class all the way, as far as I'm
Awesome.
concerned.
Do you still have any of those bows? Did you save some of those or you still
Yeah,
have those?
well, that Black Widow and a Pearson bow that I killed that first mule deer with, they're on display at Springfield in the Archery Hall of Fame Museum. I've got a back quiver I wore that Glenn St. Charles, it's a Glenn St. Charles quiver, and Glenn signed it for me, and I've got that. The bow quiver, the bear bow quiver I use today, Fred signed it for me, and I carry it for good luck.
That's pretty cool.
So I'm hunting with Glenn St. Charles and Fred Bear, and lots of memories. That's important.
That's very cool. Where are you mainly hunting right now? I know you have some property around yourself, or
Right, we're in Perry County, Indiana. This is a lot of open space, but heavily forested. There's state land, farms. It's if you know Brown County, Indiana, it's a tourist destination because of the hills and ridges and hardwood forests. Perry County is a lot like that, and I think, and I'm not exaggerating, a deer on my farm could wander around and go probably 20 to 25 miles with crossing nothing but grassy road, maybe, or a gravel road. You don't have to cross paved roads. And it's just, it's ideal for deer. And so I've tried to nurture the local herd on our farm, and I've spoiled them rotten, I guess, because there's a bunch of them hanging around.
Yeah, I really enjoy. I know you post a lot of photos each day on Facebook, and I really enjoyed your commentary and everything and the knowledge you have, and it's always something I look
Well,
forward to every day.
I'm a kind of a photo buff. I worked for a newspaper for a while. I was a sports editor and city editor, and I took a lot of pictures. And so it's natural when you write to also take pictures. And so this year so far, I've probably shot about 5,000 deer pictures here on our farm.
That's pretty
A lot
cool.
of years, I'll shoot 15 to 20,000 pictures. I mean, those cards hold a lot of images, and I go out there and click away, and I get good ones now and then. And those are the ones I share on my Facebook page.
So going back to on your first deer, like at that time, was that you? I know you had told me a while back that there was really no tree stand hunting or anything back then, correct? So everything was pretty much just stalk and Is that kind of just what everybody was doing, meaning? Okay. So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
when, I think my question was going to be like, when did like the whole tree stand like phase or popularity really kick in then?
I had a friend in Illinois who built a tree stand, if you call it that. He had took two pieces of wood that folded with a hinge, and it had spikes where you put it in a fork of a tree and then step on
Okay.
it, and you'd stand on that thing. It'd fit in your fanny pack, but and it wasn't the most stable thing. And that was before we knew anything about safety harnesses and safety
Yeah.
belts. And that's one thing now. But I always preach the gospel of don't climb without a fall restraint device.
Right.
I had a friend, we killed our first elk together in Montana, and he ended up later, he was bear hunting in, I think, Minnesota, and he fell out of a tree
Yeah.
and broke his neck and died. So, I mean, I know it can happen, and
Right.
I that's the gospel according to the book of James. You go
Yeah.
hunting and climb a tree, you wear a safety harness.
Right. I know I try to preach that all every year too, is just a reminder to, I mean, it's even if you don't want to do it to your for yourself, do it for your family, do it for your loved ones, because it's,
Yes, sir.
I mean, I'm younger than yourself, but I mean, I remember even when I started out, I mean, some of the tree stand technology was nothing great. I mean, I remember taking some old pallets and making our stuff, and luckily we never fell out of anything. But in today's world, the costs are reasonable enough to, there's no excuse not to use it. And that's, like I said, it's just a, and that's great that the industry in general has improved that much for that. And
Yeah, a lot of the guys with stands particularly that they advertised in Bowhunter, and they say, do you want a stand to run a field test on? And so I'd say, sure. So I'd do a little write-up in the magazine for it and
yeah.
let the viewers know.
Awesome. So like what was like in today's world, like hunting now compared to when you started out, what is your typical like archery setup? I mean, what are you using right now that you've like you're really comfortable with?
Well, I switched pretty much to compounds when the compound craze came in. I took one of the last bucks I killed here on the farm, and I guess that was 3 years ago. A best friend of mine in Montana passed away, and when I went out for the funeral, I spoke at his funeral. He was my dentist and one of the best friends I've ever had. He died of a heart issue. And after the service, his family gave me his favorite recurve bow and said, Chuck would want you to have this. So I decided I was going to hunt a deer here on our farm and dedicate it to Chuck's memory.
That's cool.
And I was successful. I shot a pretty nice 8 point. And I had Fred Bear's quiver, I had Chuck's bow, and I put that buck down with a single shot, one arrow. And that was extra special to me. And I wrote the story, One Last Hunt with Dr. Chuck. He was, say, my dentist, and never forget that. But I use compounds. I'm shooting a Matthews now. It's an older model. I don't go in for all the bells and whistles. I can't shoot a recurve or longbow with sights, and I can't shoot a compound without sights. Does that make sense? With me, believe me, it works for me. And I need that one pin. A lot of times, I just put a single pin on and elevate or lower to. I knew where the arrow was going to fly, but I like heavy hunting heads, heavy arrows. I'm saying heavy, 125 grains minimum, far as I'm
Okay.
concerned. And I use heavy aluminum. I've shot fiberglass back in the day when microflights were popular. I
Yeah.
shot cedar shafts out of my recurves. It's just a personal choice.
So how did you then really from getting your first whitetail, getting some small game with your archery equipment, how did you get then evolve and move into all the other big game animals that you're you've taken over the years.
Well, I decided I wanted to kill a mule deer. I've got aunts in Colorado and Wyoming. That's where I learned to ride a horse.
Okay.
And I'd see these magnificent deer with bigger antlers, by and large, than most whitetails have, the big bucks. And so I wanted to always wanted to hunt a mule deer. And one of the advertisers in their magazine, I contacted him. This was in 70, yeah, 1970, I believe, or 71. And I booked a hunt. He offered an unguided but outfitted hunt in the Book Cliffs above Rifle, Colorado. And so I drove out from Indiana. I got up at 4 in the morning. There weren't any interstates in those days, so I had to go through St. Louis and
Right.
Kansas City and Denver on my way out there.
Yeah.
But a license back then, and this is going to kill a lot of your listeners, Colorado deer license back then was $10 across the counter. Elk license was $10 across the counter.
Wow.
And total cost of that outfitted hunt was $90.
Okay.
So I was married with a couple of kids still in college and trying to make a living, but I also needed my recreation. So I drove out there. The first day, the first morning, within 2 hours, I killed a 3x3 mule deer buck that just happened to stand there too long looking at me.
Yeah.
I'd already missed one shot, but I paid, I think it was $10 or $15 to have it field dressed and put in ice. And I drove back to Indiana with that mount, not mount, but the cape and the
Okay.
antlers and the skull in this car seat behind me. I made that whole trip. And I also forgot to say, on the way out, I stayed in a motel near Aspen. And the motel room cost me $7. But the total cost of that budget bow hunt, that was what I wrote about, a budget
Yeah.
bow, cost something like maybe $110, $15.
That's
That
pretty
wasn't
cool.
bad for a big game bow hunt in Colorado.
Yeah. So of all the years you've bow hunted, what would you say has probably been the most challenging animal that you've?
Challenging.
I mean, they all are, or maybe the
A
words.
mature whitetail is still one of the
Yeah.
most challenging, and I think most of your listeners would
Yeah.
identify with that. As far as physically challenged mountain goat hunting and sheep hunting,
Okay.
I've hunted sheep in Canada. I killed a bighorn ram. I drew a license in Colorado and killed a ram out there, and I wish I'd done it when I was younger, put it that way. But I worked out and got around and
Yeah.
did well in the high country. I love caribou hunting on the Canadian tundra.
Okay.
I've hunted, if I remember correctly, of the 29 species. I think I've hunted 20. Three or four
Wow,
of them
that's pretty
successful.
awesome.
Yeah, it just, but I'm old, remember, and I get a lot of time to find deer that and
Yeah.
animals that are probably past their prime too.
That's the cool thing about hunting too. It's like no matter if it's been decades ago or yesterday, I mean, it seems like you always remember those hunts though. I even myself, I mean, I'm younger, but it's like I can flash back to when my first deer hunt and everything, and you still remember those. I mean, it's your
Right.
brain, and that's just goes to show that the passion's in your body, and you just
Yes.
that's the cool thing about it. So you can have a deer mount or hide or something on the wall, but it's like those memories are still there. And that's, I think, with my hunting page that I manage, that's one of the things I try to preach to people. It's like, even if you don't get an animal, I mean, you still, there's so many memories you bring with you each hunt. I mean, I'm sure you can, I mean, credit yourself with people you've hunted. And maybe that's another question I'll have for you. Like, who would you say are some of the, like, I'm sure you've hunted with a lot of different people over the years. Is there any maybe who kind of stands out with some of the people that you've hunted with?
Well, there's
That's
some
probably a
that,
tough question for you.
well, there's some who are pretty obvious. Chuck Adams, he lived in Montana at the time. I had that ranch out there.
Yeah.
He would come up, we'd ride horses. He's the real deal. He has taken more record book animals than any man ever. A lot of people think he's maybe egotistical and arrogant, but he's friendly when you know him, and he is a one hell of a hunter. I mean, he really, really is. I've hunted with other people whose names you would probably recognize. Jim Doherty was a good friend. We hunted Texas together several times, hunted Mississippi. I killed it. Jim was a great turkey hunter, and he just loved turkey hunting, and we went hunting. And in fact, I think Tom Nelson was along on that trip because we
Okay.
did a video for Bowhunter Magazine TV, and I killed a gobbler, and Jim didn't get one, and so I had to rub it in a little bit, but he takes it good naturedly, and he was one of the best, nicest hunters I've ever been around. Just so many people. I hate to start throwing names because
Yeah,
I'll
I totally
hit
understand that.
somebody, but let's put it this way. If you throw names my way, if anyone of your listeners were to throw names my way, I would say yeah. And that includes some of the best women bow hunters that have been around.
Awesome. Maybe I want to change the topic a little bit right now. As we were talking prior to when we were on the phone earlier, I was saying, like I said, a lot of people on this page that follow Michigan Deer Hunters. I kind of describe a lot of what I call like blue collar hunters, a lot of people with limited funds, people that maybe work a lot of hours, don't get a chance to hunt maybe the best parcel of land. I guess maybe the question I would have first of all would be like for somebody that's wanting to start out grabbing their first bow, or maybe somebody that's kind of fresh, maybe he's bow hunted 1 or 2 years, that's still really learning things. What would you say, like tips or suggestions would you give to that hunter?
Well, I would say try to find someone who knows his way around the woods. And I know that can't always be the case, but a lot of guys who belong to archery clubs particularly can find someone. And I don't know the number of people that I've tried to help over the years, and I know that that's not uncommon. If you get someone who's been there, done that, and can offer you advice on everything from what bow, what broadhead, what works well, what doesn't, and can answer your questions honestly, you'll go a long way and save yourself a lot of trial and error years, which can end up fine, but also you need a mentor or a buddy who just shares the passion like you do.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I started out. My older brother, this would have been back maybe in the late 70s. He ended up just this was back in the day where like you could buy we have some just local drug stores that are not in business anymore, but like a Perry Drug. I mean, it was a drugstore, and yet they had an archery section in there. They had some bare bows, and I know my brother picked up his first bow, and he kind of just learned as he went. And myself, my brother Tom, the younger brothers, weren't old enough to hunt yet, and yet we were just following Tim, and Tim was the guy, my older brother, where even to this day he was always the guy that would buy something, the new gadget or the new product, and he would always be like our tester. And then if it was something at work, then us the others, we'd go out and buy something. So I know he had got into back in the day, I'm trying to think, the Oneida bows. That was one thing. I saw Pollington. I got a chance to be Cobb Pollington one time. And I know, I think Ted Nugent was using that bow for a while. That was kind of popular for quite a while.
He had a zebra strike to
Yeah, that's what it
bow
was.
correctly.
Yeah, so.
I got to know those guys too, and I took that stone sheep I mentioned in British Columbia. I took with an Oneida, and I
Okay.
loved that bow. I mean, it had that look of a recurve, and it shot so fast and flat. I loved it, and I
Yeah,
still
he was the thing.
have
My brother, he swore by that bow. He really loved that. And I
I
know the
killed, in fact, I killed a caribou in Newfoundland that, by pure luck, I mean, it was the biggest one that the guides that he'd ever seen. It was, I think, number three in the world at one time. And I killed him at 20 yards with that bow, and he didn't go 20 yards after I shot him. I mean, the air blew through him, and he was leaking on both sides when he ran, and he went down right away. And any bow that can deliver a quick, clean kill, as far, of course, you have to have the well-placed arrow, but
Right.
that Oneida was a sweet, fast-shooting bow.
Yeah, very much.
Yes.
Maybe as you just talked there, let's talk. I know a lot of hunters in today's world where I'm trying to think maybe how to word this, but as far as shot placement with, I
Right.
know I've read some articles or a lot of articles with you and you preach shot placement.
Right.
And I think sometimes some hunters get a little excited where maybe they'll forget about maybe I got to wait a couple extra minutes or wait for that perfect shot, where sometimes someone might look back and say maybe I should have held off. What do you like your talk to me a little bit about that topic.
Well, it's the most important topic as far as getting success in bow hunting. I tell people I will not take a shot at a big game animal unless I can put a razor sharp broadhead through both lungs. I mean, I know quartering away, you can take shots. I killed the last buck I killed, well, this year, I killed a 14 pointer, which had more points than any buck I've ever killed, but not here on the farm. And he was quartering away, or I wouldn't have taken the shot, and he was close for another reason. And I knew I could drive the arrow completely up into his neck area, and I did. But if you don't take out both, they can go a long way on one lung. They can even survive, believe it or not, depending on where in the lung it hits, they can even survive a lung hit. But boy, you want to create massive hemorrhage, and if you center punch him in the side where you can take both lungs, I don't know. I very seldom have a deer go over maybe 30, 40, 50 yards at most.
Yeah, I mean it's a responsibility to each hunter, I mean, to take that ethical shot. And I mean, if you got a you might be upset at yourself, maybe you're gonna walk away and not get that shot up. I mean, not be able to take an animal home, but it's not about that. Like you said, it's
Well,
your
and you take a shot that's iffy, and you might not take that animal home. And he might be wasted. He might be out there somewhere where you can't find him. It's just, I like to think that most hunters empathize with the animal and they want to put the animal down quickly and humanely. That's the ideal situation as far as I'm concerned. And that's why I have guys say, oh, I decide to shoot him in the neck or shoot him in the head. You can kill a deer that way. But boy, you can wound a lot of animals. And again, they cannot live without both lungs functioning fully, and if the lungs are full of blood.
Yeah, I know Tom Nelson, he was talking about even we were talking a little bit about tree stand heights, and that's what he was saying too. You get to a certain height too, and you're taking that chance of just hitting the one
Right.
lung.
Right.
What are you normally like when you're in a tree stand? Like, is there a certain height you always preferred or?
Well, in recent years here on the farm, I've hunted off the ground more than I've hunted tree stands. I've killed a couple deer out of tree stands here, but I love having both feet on terra firma and being completely camouflaged, the wind in my face, sun at my back, and luck at my side. And that's my
Are you
motto.
using just a ground blind you build? You buy something?
Both. I have a couple of pop-up blinds, and I do use those. I will always set them up for more than one trail comes together. And I know from watching the deer, being out there with my camera, where they congregate and where they will filter in and out. And I'll set up at a junction where at least two and preferably three or four trails kind of converge there. And that's a good place. But you got to watch the wind. You can booger a spot like that in a hurry, and if they catch you one time, they might not give you a second chance.
On the same topic with somebody new hunting, somebody first year going out in the woods, got their bow in their hand. Well, maybe let's back up. Previous to that, they're scouting, looking for a spot. What do you look for? What would you tell a new hunter when they walk out in the woods scouting early? What are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for something that looks like deer would be in love with the spot. And I'm talking, there might be, we've got a hidden pond on our farm. And I shot my first buck here on the farm because I see deer and turkey watering there. And I set up a tree stand on the ridge above that, and I killed a, I think it was an 8-point buck, the first deer I took here. And I look for things like that. But there's no secret magic formula that I can share with anybody. I've helped a couple of boys kill their first deer here on our farm. And these guys, I just made sure they could shoot accurately. I was with the one boy when he killed his first deer. It was a big doe. I put a little buck scent on a stump. We double standed the tree. He was right beside me. I told him when to draw and to hold for the lungs, and he did. And that deer didn't go 50 yards, and he was tickled to death, and I was too. I mean, to see the excitement. He later killed his first buck on our farm. I was going out with him that day with my camera to take pictures, and I was running late, and he was impatient, so he went out and got one of my stands. He came up. Still, sun was up, and he was banging on the door. And I'm thinking, what? He said, "I just shot a buck." And I said, "Well, let me get my boots on, and I'll help you try." He said, no. He said he walked about 20 yards and fell over dead. So I said, "Well, let's go get him." And memories like that mean so much to me. I have had three sons. Well, the oldest one died of cancer, but I had the two other sons were all of them were exposed to bow hunting. And I only have one son, and that's our son Dave. He's our middle son. He lives in Montana. His son is now the latest James family member who has taken elk and deer and
Awesome,
bear
cool.
with his bow. And Dave taught him what I taught Dave.
Okay.
And it's a guarantee of sorts that the generations in the James family are going to continue to discover what the wild places have to offer.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I always just preach those whole memory things because, like, when we started out, it was my dad and his group of his friends. And my dad had passed a few years ago, but two of his best friends are. One's be 91 in October, and the other one I think is upper 80s. Still hunting. Have some health issues, but are still able to get out in the woods. So we used to always, right before deer season, we would always get together, and this was the back in the days before the internet and stuff, where we would do a little pre-deer season party where old guys and us young kids, we would all get together and get the magazines, the VHS tapes, and just kind of get yourself pumped up for deer season. And I know I started that tradition up again la or 2 years ago. Just everybody kind of complains nowadays where the deer camps of old, there used to always be the 20, 30 guys that go to camps, and they've kind of died out a little bit. So I came up with the idea where why don't we just, I mean, everybody's busy, everybody's got stuff going on in their life that maybe we can't all, and everybody owns little small parcels of land. Why don't we just, right before hunting season starts, let's get everybody together and just have a fun night talking deer in the backyard under a bonfire. And that's really worked out really good. And I've suggested that to a lot of people because a lot of guys and women really miss that whole deer camp atmosphere. And like I said, a lot of people now, one guy might own 10 acres or one might own 40. So not everybody is like hunting out of the exact location. And yet it's just a fun time to really get together. So like I really just those whole memory things because you can have a ton of animals on the wall or whatever, and but man, no one's ever going to take those memories away, and that's the stuff that
That's
it's
what
like
makes
there. I could probably talk to you all night long, and you could
it.
tell me stories, and that's just it's just awesome.
To give you an idea of how far I go back, the first deer I killed in Michigan, this may be of interest to your listeners. I took him off the ground. And I was hunting off the ground for a very good reason. Tree stands were illegal in Michigan at that time. And so I went up. We were living in northern Indiana. That was when I worked for the Magnavox company. And I drove up just across state line to a farm. Went out, shot this. It was a little 10-point buck, but his picture, he's just a little basket rack buck. But I put the picture on the first cover of Bow Hunter magazine with a bow hunter, one of my partners at full draw. And that was the initial issue of Bowhunter magazine. I put that little
Awesome.
buck on the
That's
cover.
pretty
And I
cool.
also feel that more guys can relate to that size buck than some of these wall hangers that you see.
Yeah, I mean, it's everybody wants would love to get a big antler
Yeah.
buck on the wall, but it's not what it's all about either.
No,
I
it's
mean,
not.
there's
And it's the friends too. And again, thinking about your Michigan listeners, I got to know Ted pretty well. And he called me one day. He said, "I'm playing a State Farm here in a State Farm State Fair here in Montana." And I told him, "If you ever get out that way, to give me a call." And he did. So he and Shemaine and Rocco came up to Whitefish,
That's cool.
and we had a ball. And he spent 2 days unwinding. You know, after performance, some of these guys have to wind down. Ted was one of those. And but we had a great time. And he called me here not too long ago, and it's always good to hear his voice.
Yeah, my first experience, he called me it's about a month and a half ago. And I mean, first you get that little bit of start. I was like, wow, Ted Newsom's on the phone. I'm talking to him. And yet you hang up the phone and it's like, he's just an average Joe guy. He likes hunting. He's passionate about, very passionate about hunting. And yet he's a rock and roller. But I mean, the guy just has the same passion me and you have with deer hunting or with hunting in general.
And his song, Fred Bear, is my favorite of it.
Yeah, I would say most hunters, that would be their. On their top list. We'll kind of wrap this up here a little bit. I just want to ask you two other things. Michigan, this coming weekend, April 20th, is our turkey season opener. Somebody, what is what? Give me a tip you would give to an archery hunter going out, trying to get their gobbler.
Well, what I do here on the farm and what I've done in Illinois, I've got a friend that owns land over there. I put up a pop-up blind, and I will make sure there's where turkeys feed, either there's natural food there or it's where they congregate. And I will put that blind up ahead of time, let them get accustomed to it. And I will go in the dark, put up my decoy. Or I've got a mounted hen, an actual turkey mount that I use. I call her Jezebel, and I'll stick her on the ground and I'll get in there. And when they start talking from the trees, I start talking back. Wait for them to fly down. Sometimes they'll go away to feed, or sometimes they'll come right in. And I like to hunt turkeys out of a blind and get shots real close. And I'm talking under 20 yards typically. And as close, I've killed turkeys at 10 yards too. So, but you gotta draw, and boy, their eyesight's so
Yeah, it's got to be pretty
I
tough.
don't have to tell you. And that's why I'll draw and then lean into the shooting lanes real
Oh,
slow
okay.
and take the shot.
Yeah, it's quite the accomplishment then. How about the last question I have for you tonight would be, what are your words? A lot has changed in the hunting industry, hunting world over the decades. What would be your words of advice to maybe people, states and stuff that are in charge of hunting regulations and everything, hunters? What words would you give, I guess, the overall industry?
Well, and I would advise the state people, and I've been blessed to be involved in some efforts to change seasons or to help benefit hunters by lengthening seasons and timing, all this sort of thing. And I would say get involved some way. There are a lot of bow clubs at Tysepe Bow Hunters. We got involved with legislation efforts there in the state. Attend the meetings. I've gone to public meetings where sportsmen and women get up and share ideas. And you need to talk to people in positions of power or control to establish lines of communication. And they understand maybe that some of the things you're going to offer wouldn't work. And they may tell you that, but they also can get some good ideas from people who are out there seeing it. I don't know what else to say other than you be involved as most you can and talk to as many people as you can who will have a say in the future of hunting or a particular species.
Yeah, you can't always just assume that the next person is going to do it. I mean, you need to be that next person. You need to stand up, and even though maybe you might not think your voice is heard, but you need to put your voice out there. And that's some great advice, because and like I said, every state, every county pretty much across America has different challenges that they're dealing with in the hunting industry. And I know just so many issues going on, but like you said, I mean, you have to speak up, and let's try to hopefully, as a hunting community, stick together and try to do what's best for not only hunting in general, all species.
Yeah, and we need to be pulling in the same direction. I mean,
yeah.
You get guys that have ideas that just, they might appeal to them, but they're not going to work when you're talking a whole state full of people.
Right.
And be selective, but push your ideas, because maybe some of these people haven't even heard what idea you come up with. So don't be bashful. Get out there and talk.
Well, I want to thank you tonight for joining me. It's been a lot of fun talking to you, and I'm sure we'll keep in touch, and we'll maybe sit down again and we'll do one of these again now that we have the video thing all figured out tonight. But I really enjoyed talking to you, and I really get just wish you the best. Are you going to be hunting anytime soon, or is your turkey season
turkey
or anything going on?
It's in a week from today.
Okay.
And I will be in the woods, yes.
Awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and keep me posted how you do, and maybe
thanks,
we'll
Dale. I appreciate it.
Bump into each other sometime in person or whatever, and we'll get a chance to sit down with some.
Look forward to it. Maybe
person
Tom,
talk
you
or
and I can get together sometime.
Hey,
That'd be
I would enjoy that.
Okay. You
Well,
take
thank you
care.
Very much for sitting down with me, and you have a great week and happy
You
hunting.
too. You too.
Take care.
Bye now.